Hey guys, it's Albert. We're going to kick things off by talking about what else the pass interference call in the Saints-Rams NFC Championship game. Jenny and Connor are in to discuss all the news, and as always, we wrap things up with a six-pack of your Twitter questions. Let's go. All right, welcome back in. The conference championship games are in the books. I am live from Mobile, Alabama. Took a little bit, but we got everything hooked up here. And Jenny and Connor are back in New York. Super Bowl 53 on the horizon. Just about 10 days from now. Is my math right on that, guys? 10 days from now, the Los Angeles Rams and the New England Patriots will face off. Be the Patriots going for their sixth world championship. The Rams for their second Super Bowl championship, and their first is the Los Angeles Rams. And we're going to do things a little different this week because it was sort of a fire drill getting me hooked up in the first place. We're going to skip the opening monologue. We're going to jump right into the topics because there are a couple things from those conference championship games that just jump off the page at you. And Jenny, Connor, like, two great games, right? Like two fantastic games. Like two, like this should be a banner day for the NFL. And unfortunately, I think all anybody could talk about on Monday, when we all should have been talking about this just incredible day of football, was stuff unrelated to the quality of play out there.
Yeah, we were watching, you know, I was at Arrowhead and we were watching the end of the Rams Saints game. You know, everyone's in the press box crowded around the TVs, and it was just funny to hear the reaction there of the entire room be like,
yeah, what was it like?
You know, just everyone, you know, made some kind of noise when we saw that pass interference was not called, you know, because everyone in the room saw it at the same time. And then you see, you know, the way the play unfolded, and the whole room just like kind of erupted in, you know, like disbelief.
I mean, right. At the Superdome, like we're up, you know, we're up towards the ceiling almost.
Like that press box is in like outer space.
Yeah, it's very high up, but you know, and so we're up towards the ceiling, and we're also on the opposite side. We're on the same bench side, but the opposite side of the field is where the pass interference play happened. And even then, like, you know, I said that the players to me were about the size of pocket chess pieces, but you could see that, and everyone on press row just erupted, and then the stadium lost it. That was the loudest stadium that I've ever been to. I consulted because I watched the third quarter down in the first row with some Saints fans. They said that was the highest they had seen the Mercedes decibel mm-hmm. noise meter. It was as loud as an airplane taking off without headphones if you were just standing underneath an airplane. And so, you know, to imagine that all like converting to booze at one moment was like really like a stunning thing to hear.
So booze, I'm interested.
B-O-O-S, not booze, just to stick that in, sorry. But it probably was converted to booze as well.
It definitely was converted to booze.
All right, so we'll just jump into the news topics then. News topic number one, the New Orleans Saints, and we're already there, but the New Orleans Saints lost in heartbreaking fashion to the LA Rams in the NFC title game, in part on one of the most egregious non-calls in league playoff history. I'd say league history, period. An apology from the league and strong statements from both Saints head coach Sean Payton and owner Gail Benson have prompted renewed discussion about the ability to challenge judgment calls. And I don't think we've seen a public apology from the league, have we, yet?
No.
Like, no, because they apologized to Payton, but they haven't apologized publicly yet. Guys, all right, so the first thing I want to ask, because Connor, you were there, is – it was obvious to all of us on TV. You had the benefit of being in the stadium and like seeing that happen in real time. Was it as obvious in real time, like looking down in the field? Like, could you see it right away?
Oh, yeah.
Or, okay.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, the ball was behind him. We had a good angle, you know, in terms of like the play was coming towards us at least. So, you know, you could see that how far the pass was behind Tommy Lee Lewis. But I think my favorite part of that after the game was there was a small group of reporters around Nickell Robey-Coleman, and someone said, hey, have you seen the video yet? And he said, no. And someone said, if I show it to you right now, would you tell us what you think? And he said, yeah. And so we pulled up the video, and he puts his arm around one of the reporters, and as he sees himself like destroying Tommy Lee Lewis, he grabs the reporter by the shoulder and just starts shaking him, and then goes, oh, hell yeah, that was pass interference. And so it was obvious to us. It was obvious to him. And apparently just not the three officials that were in the vicinity there. So,
but that's like a really good example of why, like, that's a really, like, that anecdote right there explains perfectly why the league has just, like the way in which the league has just totally made this way worse than it needed to be, right? Because they take Vinovich and they give him to the pool reporter, right? And how easy was it for you guys to pull that up and show it to Roby Coleman?
Took,
like, two clicks on your phone,
if
right?
Not, yeah, if that, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, so, like, how is it that the NFL, right? How is it that the NFL is sending their head official, like the head official they assigned to the NFC Championship game, into a room with a pool reporter when they know the reason the pool reporter, the reason that the media wanted the ref in the first place was this one single moment, right? How is it, like how does it make any sense that the NFL does that without pulling out an iPad, pulling out an iPhone, and saying, hey, just so you know, this is all you're going to be asked about. So you might want to take a look at it first. Like, how in the world is that? Like, that's why, like, I look at it. It almost has to be willful, right? Like a delay tactic so
yeah.
they can get their ducks in a row.
Like,
that's what it feels like to me.
Plausible deniability, I suppose. So it has to be something like that. But if you look at the replay, Vinovich is looking in the direction of the play,
yeah.
which is kind
yeah,
of,
there's
you
a
know,
smoking gun there.
Right? So it's remarkable that he says he didn't see it, but he appears to be looking directly at the play.
It doesn't make a lick of sense.
The one thing I will say, and obviously it's not funny for Saints fans, but I have enjoyed like the Zapruder level, like instances. Like there's different angles now. There's like
that happens with all.
There's like the grassy
now,
knoll
though.
View of this now, and everyone's like, well, look at the wide angle. You know, this ref is like pretend like he's checking his cell phone because he's hearing from the league that they have to, you know, get the Saints out of the playoffs. And like, there's just this amazing, like it's turned into like a horrific miscall. Obviously, like someone was totally asleep at the wheel, probably zoned out or something that happened that way. The league's trying to cover up for it, but now we're getting so deep into the conspiracy weeds, and that's really where I shine.
But that's the thing is, like, guys, like that's the, like, how often has this been the problem for the league, though, where they don't confront problems, they manage them, right?
Yeah,
like
reacting, like, not being proactive. Yeah,
right. More like, and much more serious cases, like the obvious example is what was the string of domestic violence issues that the league had and the way they handled those. And it would be like sort of waiting for public reaction and then reacting to that, you know, rather than just confronting it on the front end. And it's like, it all goes back to like, and I remember saying this during, you know, was 2014 when Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson and Greg Hardy happened. And it's like, it's that little thing your mom and dad give you to be able to tell what's right and wrong, right? Like, and if you're not going on that, then you can sort of get yourself in trouble. And it feels like that's like, this is another one of those where what's the right thing to do? Well, the right thing to do is just admit that there was a problem, like admit that that was a missed call and it's horrible. And like, and they can't even do that. Like in a situation like this, where there's no one on the planet that looked at that play and says, yeah, like that, like there's an argument the other way. No one's saying that. Right. And they can't, like in this situation, they can't even, like in something that's so obvious, they still can't confront the problem. They're still trying to manage it on the back end. It makes no sense.
I mean, what if Goodell had been at the Superdome instead of Arrowhead? Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been an interesting scene. Would he have gone down to talk to Peyton? What would have been
really
like leaving the hotel or leaving the stadium and going to the plane or a hotel or wherever he would have gone? I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about that. I mean, when you speak about being reactive and not proactive, I mean, Belichick for several years now has said that
yep.
everything should be reviewable. And it's a simple solution that would not necessarily extend the length of any game. And, you know, Belichick is often right about rules. Like he, you know, when he says something, it oftentimes is the way to go. And I
right.
don't know why they haven't taken that suggestion more seriously.
Because, well, and so I remember him making the comment. You remember, like there was a, he said there was some sort of controversial call in one of their games, basically involving the goal line. And he's like, I don't know why we can't just put cameras in the pylons. Like, and then that was when he made the bake sale comment, right? Like he was like, I don't know, maybe they can't afford it. Maybe we'll put together a bake sale for them so we can get the cameras and the pylons. And this is like the same sort of thing. It's like whenever he retires, the league should just appoint him like the minister of common sense, because a lot of the stuff that he like suggests or brings up at league meetings are common sense, and this would be so easy to do. You know, like when you've got great technology to be able to see things from so many different angles and see things so clearly, it just doesn't make any sense that you wouldn't take advantage of that, you know, and take advantage of the idea that, yeah, we can do this a better way and we don't have to get these calls wrong.
I think that, you know, at this point, there's enough momentum. This was a good season for the league, and I think that they have the equity back with the fan base to say, hey, you know, maybe we're going to make the game time. And it's, like Jenny said, it's not going to really extend the time of the game, but maybe over the life of the season, it extends a game, you know, a minute or 2 minutes longer than it already is. I think they have the equity to be able to do that now. I think last season they were so sensitive about everything about, you know, the games are too long, they're too soft, they're too political, they're too everything. And I think they have the momentum back in terms of that. I think so long as the Super Bowl kind of keeps them on that path, I think that this should pass without any sort of difficulty. I don't think anybody's going to be worried now about extending the time of the game. I don't think that should be a concern.
I also think like one way you could alleviate that, Connor, is to just take the reviews off the field and have them either do them in New York or have a replay official in the booth handle it. Like, if you really want to expedite those, there's a way to do it. Now, I know that might cost them the Microsoft sponsorship or whatever, but like there is, you see it in college, you know, like where there's somebody dedicated to doing that and that's his job. Like, it seems to me like that would be the most, like a way more efficient way of doing it than having someone, you know, trudge over to the sideline and sit underneath a hood for like a minute or two.
Do you want the original? This is the exclusive Connor Orr fix to that problem, right? This is, and you can double up on sponsorships too, right? You put 1 minute running clock on the league, on the replay team, Riveron and the crew, because, you know, if you're challenging a judgment call, it should be obvious enough that it's obvious to Riveron within a minute anyway, right? Mm-hmm. And then you say it's the Timex minute challenge, you know, whatever countdown.
There it is.
And so, you know, just 345 Park, if you want to get at me. I'm not too far away from you guys today.
I agree, like, that, like, 100% that have, like, some sort of shot clock, because
yeah.
The other piece of this is, like, in the New England game, you had the Edelman muff, right? That wasn't, like, to me, like, that wasn't, I don't know, like, I would have left that alone, whether they called it a fumble, whether they ruled that he touched it or not, because I didn't think anything was so conclusive there, like overwhelming. And that's what replay's there for. Replay's there to overturn the obvious calls. It's not there so, you know, they can go and clean up something that's like really close, you know? So putting a shot clock on it, I think would allow you, would give you the chance there to say, okay, if it's not obvious and it takes you more than 60 seconds to see it, then, like, you shouldn't be overturning it anyway. Yeah. So, all right.
Topic
news
number
item number two. Okay.
Well, I'll Jen, go because I've got it up.
We're in two different places, so mechanically there are some hiccups. There could be a hiccup or two here. Go ahead, Jenny.
We also have a new script writer this week, so it's a little spicier, some of the adjectives here.
Yep.
Tom Brady and the Patriots edged the Chiefs at Arrowhead in the primetime game, giving New England their third straight Super Bowl berth and ninth under head coach Bill Belichick. The league's pluckiest underdog now has the stiff task of taking on the high-powered Rams in the big game. I did appreciate Brady's reaction in the post-game press conference when someone asked him, you know, do you really believe the underdog stuff? And he kind of just tilted his head and was kind of like, yeah, like, you know, move on to the next question. It was pretty amusing. But I mean, it's really just, I don't know. I think covering this era, you know, you just have to have an appreciation for what you're seeing and the fact that we will never see anything like this again. You know, the underdog thing. So they're using it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know, Albert, you hate it, but I get it. Like, you know, 3-5 in the road, and everyone figured Brady was going over the cliff. So we're just going to hear about it for a few more weeks.
Well, no, and like, so here's the thing. Like, I don't mind. Like, it doesn't bother me if like an athlete is going to, you know, just gin up anger over something, right? Like, it doesn't bother me if he's going to if they want to manufacture motivation, whatever you got to do, it's fine. Like that's just them, right? What, like, is really sort of obnoxious to me is other people jumping on and saying, oh yeah, they were doubted. Well, were they really doubted? I think everybody thought, and maybe I'm talking out of school here, but I think everybody thought that there was a pretty good chance they were going to get back to the conference championship game. And if if you're saying a team is likely to get back to the conference championship game, it's really hard for me to sit here and say, like, you were being disrespected all year. Do they have problems? Yes. Like, they did. The bar is higher for them because they have Brady and Belichick. And the bar should be higher for them because they have Brady and Belichick. So we talk about them in a very different way than we talk about other teams, right? That's just the way it is. It's like, I mean, I think the best analogy is probably LeBron. Like, LeBron's not held to the same standard as everyone else in the NBA, and he shouldn't be because he's more gifted than anyone else in the NBA, you know? And so I just think – I think it's fair to hold a group of players or a single player who is transcendent to a higher standard. And I think that's what happens here. And, of course, the players, because, you know, they feel like they need that motivation, maybe they take that and they project it as something that it really isn't.
I think they get the ultimate respect from everybody. You know, I think that even if we're trying to politely discuss decline, there is that qualifier that, you know, everyone puts into anything that they say about the Patriots, which is, well, they'll probably be back in the AFC Championship game anyway. You know, I think that we say right. we say whatever we're going to say, whatever the sort of the in-the-moment observations are. And there's that ultimate qualifier, and it's set in stone. And so I think that, you know, but like – I don't know. I don't have a problem. If you can actually make that locker room believe that they are being overlooked, God bless you, because you have more control over those players mentally than I think that any of us believed you did before.
Is anybody stunned they're here?
No, I mean, you know, I picked them in the preseason to win the Super Bowl. So, yeah. I figured that they had a pretty good chance to be back. I mean, I do think there were times this year that they didn't look like the same dominant team, and they would admit that. You know, there was that low point. They all seem to think that low point, and from the outside it certainly looked like this, was after the back-to-back losses to Miami and Pittsburgh, and suddenly, you know, they weren't going to be the number one seed. And would they even get a first-round bye? And then that's when they really rallied, and really the last four games have been their best of the season, and here they are, you know, getting better when it's the most important, putting together game plans that, even if they're not surprising, you know, still manage to dominate the opponent.
I have to say that
this
kind of dovetails into like my favorite genre of coach motivation, which is, I think it was Nick Saban 2 or 3 years ago, before the national championship game, was just posting fake newspaper headlines in the locker room, like why Alabama's the worst football team ever, and just like completely making them up, and they were so over the top. And so I was wondering if Belichick maybe did that, like, you know,
literal fake news,
like Breer column, Patriots dynasty over, like that's just hanging over the hanging over the lock of the entrance
because there's nothing actually out there for him.
Yeah. And they just have to make
like
it up.
I mean, like, and I always think back, and I know I've brought this up to you guys before, but it's like the 2004 Patriots were sort of at that point where they were going into win their third Super Bowl in 4 years. And, you know, it was Rodney Harrison, and I've told this story before, but Rodney Harrison, after they beat the Steelers in the AFC Championship game, comes out and says, "No one believed in us. Y'all didn't believe in us. Take that. Like we proved all you wrong." Meanwhile, they were favored on the road in the AFC Championship game against a 15-1 team that blew them out during the season. If that's not respect, I don't know what is. And so there was that. And then I think it was 13 days later, whatever. They're going in the Super Bowl. And Saturday night, what does Bill use to push the players a little further over the edge? He reads the Philadelphia parade route, right? Now, every city, like both L.A. and Boston right now are making plans for parades, right? Because you can't just put that together in 2 days after you win a Super Bowl.
Boston Bill might be able to by now.
Yeah, I mean, with sort of old hat there. I like he takes little things and I would imagine that in this case Bill's probably twisting that knife a little bit again and saying, this person said this, this person said that, this person said this. Brady, you're done. Edelman, you're done. Gronk, like, I mean, they were calling him Frankenstein in the middle of the year on Boston Sports Radio. I'm sure that's gotten back to him, you know. So I understand why players would do it. I get it. But I don't think the rest of us just have to, like, buy it hook, line, and sinker, you know, because they're not the underdog.
Yeah, no, I mean, I picked the Panthers to go to the Super Bowl, but you know, so I'm sort of I shouldn't be even included in this conversation. But if you would have said to me, I picked the Panthers because I just didn't feel like picking the Patriots to go to the Super Bowl again.
I picked the Vikings to win the Super Bowl.
So I'm the only one that has, you know, has a pick still alive. So, you know, well, just says a lot. News item number three, Connor.
All right, let's do this. With both games going to overtime, fan bases of both losing teams, and I should include here probably the general media as a whole, have raised concerns about the legitimacy of overtime. Is it a fair representation of the game, or is there a better way to solve extra time? I've enjoyed sort of the conversations here because, you know, it's a fight between the college purists who think that they've got it all figured out and that there's nothing nothing better than what they have, and the NFL purists who are saying that really the current overtime is the best representation of it. You know, I think that I don't know what you would do for it. I mean, you could go to the college option, but I think that that would take away from, you know, part of the drama. I think that, yes, it does come down a little bit to a coin toss, but what else are you going to do?
I've got an interesting theory on this. I sort of think gambling in fantasy might be a factor there too, like why they wouldn't. I know it sounds crazy, but it's such a huge like revenue driver for the league, right? Like both fantasy and gambling. It's such a huge part of the football season for so many of their consumers. Like overtime, like having college overtime would sort of wreak havoc on that, wouldn't it?
Maybe. Right.
Well, because
it dramatically inflates the score.
Over unders, like touchdown score. Like if you look at some of these college games, right? Like it was Texas A&M and LSU went to like 7 overtimes, and I think someone in that game scored 6 touchdowns. Like there would be stuff like that, you know, like the and it, like that part of it. Like so, I wonder if that like could be a part of it. Like the other thing you hear like coaches bring up a lot too is the elimination of special teams in college overtime. Like in that I know Belichick was really big on this, was that it's not like the rest of the game, and it should be like the rest of the game, and the rest of the game has special teams, and so it doesn't make sense to take special teams out of it, which is I think a fair point to make about college versus pro.
I don't think they're going to change it again. They don't the tweak they made in the rules, it hasn't been that long. I don't think they're going to change it again. The other thing is
I think it's good the way it is.
I think it's good the way it is because it offers a pretty expedient way for the game to end. And we know the NFL is obsessed with two things. One is keeping the length of the games shorter, and the second is they don't want to look like they're doing, I mean, except for things like Thursday Night Football and other issues, but they are interested in not looking like they're making any rule changes that would, you know, be counter to player safety, right? So if you have an overtime experience,
unless they can monetize it,
correct? Which Thursday Night Football obviously is, but you know, I don't think that going to a system that would make the games last longer, it goes in counter to both of those items, right? And so that's why I think it's actually I don't have a problem. Defense is part of the game too, right? You know, stop the Patriots on one of those third and tens, and the Chiefs do get the ball back. So I mean, I don't know. I think the overtime conversation is a little bit overblown, and obviously it's because both games went to overtime. But
I'm sorry, but the fact that you like, I think we all would have liked to see Patrick Mahomes have a shot with the ball in overtime, right? Based on the way he played, but that's not a reason to change the rules because you wanted to see that. You know what I mean? Like that's to me, like that doesn't rise to the level of making a major rule change. I think the way that they changed the rule a couple of years ago when they made it so you couldn't win in sudden death was a good one because kickers are too good now and they can kick it from too far out, which means you wouldn't have to do much to get in position to win the game. I think this solves that. And if you can't stop another team from driving the entire length of the field, well, then I sort of don't have a ton of sympathy for you anyway, like you said, Jenny.
This is what drives me nuts about this argument is that it's sort of, you know, what do we hear every 4 years from the people who pretend to like soccer over here is that, you know, the World Cup penalty kicks are such a horrible way to decide a game, even though they're awesome. And what do they always say? This should just be a continuation of overtime until somebody scores. But then those same people say that football needs to adjust their overtime, and football overtime is exactly what they want from soccer, which is just a continuation of the game. until someone scores. And so I think that it's completely ridiculous. It's the most organic organic, true to the game way to solve it. It's not like we're having, you know, people like Mahomes and Brady see who can throw the ball farther or something like totally unrelated to the game. So I think it's fine.
That would be fun, though.
That would be awesome.
I mean, like in a perfect world, like if there weren't the one idea that I sort of would like is if they played a full period, if they played like 10 minutes, you know, which I guess would be sort of like more like basketball then, right? Like where you play a full period. Mm-hmm. And then the problem with that is that if you're doing that, then it's like you go into double overtime and now it's like, you know, are you playing for double overtime? And then, you know, you're talking about probably a different thing altogether. So I think that this is, there's not a perfect solution, but I think that they've got a pretty good setup the way it is now. Even though everybody would have liked to see Patrick Mahomes get one more crack at that on Sunday. All right, news item number 4, a spicy. And remember, I'm not the one writing the headlines today, so this is not me.
Spicy
article in the Philly Voice suggested that Carson Wentz is selfish, overcomplicates the offense, and only likes throwing to Zach Ertz.
That's true. That was what
the article said.
It said that.
This reminds me of when I was covering the Cowboys and T.O. accused Tony Romo of that with Jason Witten. So with Nick Foles decision looming, is this a harbinger? God damn it, Connor. I was out late last night, and now I can't. Now there are all these big words in front of me. Is this a harbinger of strange things to times to come? Is that the right pronunciation? Harbinger?
I think it's harbinger, yeah.
Harbinger, okay. Harbinger of strange times to come. Or can we lock in the Super Bowl 52 MVP playing elsewhere in 2019? I do think that there's some legitimacy to the Wentz story. I think it was a little over the top, but I will say like Wentz has a little bit of a reputation of, I think hardo is the right way to describe it. He does work his ass off. He is very faithful. He is like he is a lot of the things he says he is. Like I think one thing that wears on people a little bit is that he sort of has to let everybody know how hard he's working. He lets everybody know.
J.J. Watt syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of that. So I think that there's that. I don't think they invested so much in Carson Wentz. The Nick Foles story is great. He played really, really well towards the end of the year. I don't think we can forget that, like, Foles didn't play great in September. This is academic. Like, I think you move on from Nick Foles. If you can get something for him, great, but you move on from Nick Foles and you're going with Carson Wentz now.
And I think we see so often, you know, players the year after an ACL tear just aren't, you know, take a while to get back to form. And, you know, Wentz's injury occurred about a month later than Watson's, and I think that really affected his timeline. You know, when it happened in December, he wasn't ready for the start of the year.
And Watson wasn't great at the beginning of the year either.
Exactly. So then add on the 4 or 5 weeks that Wentz got injured after Watson. And so I think we'll see a different player in 2019. And I think that, you know, the narrative surrounding it will be a little bit different. I mean, I do think Nick Foles was played better for the team, of course, than Wentz did during, you know, but I think there's, you know, different circumstances. And I don't think that we can judge the future of Wentz's career based on the way that he played in 2018.
I agree with that.
I will say I think the article cited 6 people. And if it's 6 people that, you know, then it's probably 6 people that aren't going to be there next year.
Right.
Well, if you want to build around Carson Wentz, which you're going to because it's the sensible thing. I mean, I think it's easy enough for Howie Roseman and Doug Peterson to figure out the guys who don't jibe with Carson Wentz's personality, and they just aren't going to be part of the team next year.
And you wrote this in the morning huddle or something, I think, Connor, and I think it was a good point. It's like when you hear, you know, in any workplace, there's going to be a certain, you know, people feel different ways, right? And when you're quoting anonymous sources, you're not, you know, anchoring that, you know, who is this player? Are they a starter? Is it one of his top receivers? You don't really have any idea. And so while some of the sentiments might be shared, you know, I think Mike Garafolo had put it well, I thought, the other day when he talked about this, that maybe some of the context was lacking, right? So maybe some of these feelings are legitimate there, but it's not quite to the degree that it was presented.
Well, it's like any workplace, right? Not our workplace, but any other
not
workplace.
Not ours. We are one big happy
family. You can easily find six people who hate me at Sports Illustrated.
There's no finger pointing, no backstabbing, none of that going on at our place. But I but you know, like, that sort of thing does exist. Like, that's part of the work environment. And look, I mean, with other quarterbacks, there are issues. You know, like Ben Roethlisberger isn't universally loved by all of his teammates. I'd say Cam Newton sort of the same way. Like, there are certain quarterbacks that. I mean, look, there's some star quarterbacks do everything they can to try to be just another guy in the team. And then there are others who are sort of separate from the team. Brett Favre, I believe, had his own locker room in Green Bay when he at the end of his career. And so there are different ways to do it. And that means these guys fit into their teams in different ways. And so, like, there's probably some jealousy involved, I think. There is jealousy of quarterbacks in some places. And then I think the other piece of it is just what we're talking about, which is, like, it's pretty hard in any workplace to be, like, universally liked.
Albert, next week as content coordinator of the MMQB, next week an article comes out that says 6 Sports Illustrated staffers have anonymously said that it's basically the same thing about you that people
well, the
say.
Nice
that,
thing,
what's the move there? What do you do?
The nice thing about that is our staff is, like, small enough where
that's
I'd
true.
Be
that would be all of us.
Six would probably be a majority. Yeah. 6 would be extremely troubling in our workplace, actually. That might be, like, everyone that you work with.
I'd probably be able to smoke you guys out pretty good there.
You would, if it was Connor, you might be able to tell by his use of adjectives.
Yeah. Yeah. If spicy was included.
Spicy popped up in the quote.
Yeah. Breer's move was a harbinger of dark days to come.
Yeah!
That'll be my lodestar.
That's your lodestar. All right, topic number 5. Sean McVay can be the youngest head coach to win a Super Bowl by almost 4 years. He is more than half Belichick's age, which sets up a millennial versus baby boomer war that could potentially have ripple effects far beyond the gridiron. This is another or specialty. And, you know, I guess
there's a lot of drama in that headline.
Yeah,
sorry, guys.
McVay technically is a millennial, you know. I'm technically a millennial, and I've sort of raged against that classification because I didn't have social media in high school, and we had to share a family cell phone, so I don't really feel like I fit in, and maybe McVay has some of those feelings. You know, I talked to Wade Phillips a few weeks ago for a story, and he said that McVay, and I think this is very true, and from if anyone who knows him, which most of those people are now in head coaching jobs, of course, but you know, he's kind of an old soul, and I don't think he, like, you know, there's a lot of ways in which he sort of acts well beyond his years, and that's why he's in this position, I think, 2 years into his head coaching career.
And I can't get enough of, like, the, like, all the facts about his age, like, and I'm sure it's, like, probably annoying him at this point a little bit, but, and I know it's probably annoying other people too to hear all this stuff, but, like, the stuff, like, so Amanda Belichick, Bill's oldest child, right? Amanda Belichick graduated from Phillips Andover Academy in 2003.
Oh, is that when McVay was born?
And Sean McVay graduated from the Marist School in Atlanta in 2004. So Bill has a kid who graduated high school the year before McVay graduated high school. And I think Sean was a sophomore in high school when Bill won his first championship as a head coach in the NFL.
Wow.
And I also believe, I can't get enough of these. I'm sorry, guys. Sean was also one year old. God, I'm really struggling today. 1 year old when Bill was the defensive coordinator for the Giants in Super Bowl 27.
That's a good
19?
One.
21. Yeah.
That's a spicy fact there.
That is spicy.
Lots of spicy
or
facts.
Might say, yeah.
Are you technically Gen X, Albert? Are you technically a Gen Xer?
No, you know what? You know what? I think, like, so I'm born in 1980. So we're sort of like this gap generation where I think it's like somebody told me it was like 77 to 83. If you were born in that, like, and I'd be right in the middle of that.
The lost generation.
Like, you aren't really part of, like, there's no, like, real label on your generation, which is weird, right? But I think we're sort of in this, like, weird middle group.
Yeah, you had dial up. You didn't have cell phones in high school. You know, you played Oregon Trail. I mean, all of these things I fit into as a 1984er. And I feel like Sean McVay probably wouldn't like to be classified as millennial. But maybe we can ask him on Super Bowl Media Night.
That will be my goal. That's
Connor, we're going to station you by McVay. Do you identify?
So your question is, what, like, how do you phrase it? Is it, are you a millennial, Sean? Is
do
that,
you identify?
Sean, do you represent
millennial?
Us? Like, can you lead us into the future?
Yeah.
Us millennials.
Yeah, I did not have a cell phone until my, for the record, I did not have a cell phone until the summer between my sophomore and junior year in college. And Wi-Fi, I think, was sort of, Wi-Fi became like, I remember somebody in my fraternity had Wi-Fi in his room in 2002. And I swear to God, it was like the moon landing. You know what I mean? Like for us, like, oh my God, like you can take your laptop wherever you go and it still has internet.
My sister was born in 1981. She got an email account when she went to college, and this was like a huge happening. And then she had like a computer in her dorm room with dial-up, and she had Napster. I mean, this was this is not the same thing that these millennials had when they went to college. Right. I'm just
Do you guys remember the gateway computers? Like everybody. So when I went to college, everybody had the It was that big box that like had the cow spots.
The cow spots on it, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and these were just these massive computers, and it was like it was considered cool because the computer was really big, the screen was huge, and
I don't know what you guys are talking about. My whole life has been designer cupcakes and truffle fries, so you know it's been been pretty good to be.
I think I was probably out of college before I knew what truffle was.
Oh, I didn't know what truffle was until like last year.
I knew what truffle was because there was a cartoon, and I don't remember which cartoon it was, but there was like a dog that went into the forest and smelled truffles.
Oh.
Like it was a pig, or a pig, excuse me, not a dog.
It was in a cartoon?
Yeah, it was in a cartoon. Yeah, I'm going to have to look this up. Hmm. Yeah, maybe I just watched some high-level cartoons that taught me how to pronounce Harbinger.
All right, so like, let me ask you guys this. Do you think the hires of guys like Zach Taylor and Matt LaFleur and Cliff Kingsbury, do you think McVay's success in the playoffs further validate what those teams did?
Yeah, no, so I wrote this, last week. And basically, you know, because I said that we're all, not us in particular, but I think that the media and largely a lot of the fans and even the owners to some extent put people into boxes, right? There's like the veteran head coach, and there's the young offensive hot mind, and like all these things. They kind of view them as like archetype characters, in movies and stuff like that. And so, at the start of the playoffs, when it was Sean McVay, Andy Reid, Sean Payton, and you know all these guys with all this experience, it's like, what happens if the Rams lose by 40 points at the Superdome? You know what I mean?
Right?
Would that have hurt? The idea that now all these Sean McVays are coming into the league the way that everybody thought of it, and does winning the Super Bowl sort of embolden the people who then made that decision?
Yeah, you know,
I don't think.
Oh, go ahead, Albert.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that. I mean, I think one thing from the playoffs that stood out to me is like, really think Josh McDaniels should have been coaching the Packers. Like, it's just hard to watch what he did on Sunday. And
oh my God, yeah.
You know, I mean, like, think about like how do the Packers watch that and think? And this is no slight on Matt LaFleur. I have no idea if he'll be a good head coach. I have never met him, and perhaps he will be great. But if you watch the game plan that McDaniels had with, you know, for the past two games, his relationship with Brady, it's just hard to see that and the details of that. You know, Peter King wrote that they installed 8 new plays the morning of the game, and he called that slant to Gronk that wasn't even in the game plan.
Forget even that. Like, they reinvented who they were on offense, like
right.
on the fly.
On
like
the
they,
fly.
They're a
yeah.
they're like
they're
a power running
team. Yeah,
right. Like they did that on the fly, and they became something they weren't before. It's yeah, I agree with you on Josh. Like, I think Josh, I think there was like I didn't I like and I I'm this is going to be an accountability check for me. I did not think that I thought the stink of what happened in Indy was off of him. And I think that he did pay for that a little bit this year, where maybe some of these general managers were worried, like, is he going to come in here and sort of make this his show? And like when I've spent a year or 2 years or whatever it is making it my show, like, I think there was some element of that where he's going to have to earn the trust back of some of those people. But I'm with you. I don't know how you could watch what Josh has done this year in general with a diminished Gronk, with a diminished Edelman. And not and the Gordon situation too. You consider that he becomes an important part of your offense, and then you pull him out of there in the middle of December. I don't know how you could look at that and say, God, it would have been really, really interesting to see Aaron Rodgers with that guy on his side.
Yeah, you know, and Albert, as an accountability check for myself too, like I wrote in December that I thought McDaniels and McCarthy would be, you know, would have a pick of jobs. And that has been totally inaccurate. But it wasn't just based on nothing. I talked to three team decision makers and that's what they said. If I was hiring this year and none of them ended up hiring this year. So maybe that is, says something else, you know, that they have coaches that they didn't have to be in a hiring spot. But they all said, I would look at McCarthy and McDaniels first. And so I am surprised that neither of them is a head coach heading into 2019.
Well, and I think so much of it's just circumstantial too. I mean, like it's just, it sort of reminds you that this, there isn't like this consortium picking the coaches, right? Like there's individual people with individual likes and dislikes and feelings on people and all of that stuff. Like these are individual decisions. It's not like there's, that's like kind of the trouble with putting together a list like you did in the middle of the year, Jenny, is that it's just, it's not like there's this like panel that's picking the coaches, you know,
right?
It's individual people. And sometimes it can come down to like, I'm just not comfortable with that guy.
I mean, you know, the Packers would have been good with McDaniels, but would they have been fast and LaFleurious, you know? That's the question you have to ask yourself.
It's unfortunate that you couldn't get that in one of your headlines. Really unfortunate.
I have plenty of time. Plenty of time.
It's disappointing. It's disappointing. I will say, so I don't think, like, I don't know that it validates, I don't know that, the Rams being here validates, like is this massive validation of what the Packers or the Cardinals or the Bengals are doing. Like I don't view it that way. But if you were sitting and waiting for the Rams to get blown out so you could criticize, like, what those teams did, then you can't sit here now and say it's irrelevant that they're winning, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that we do as a football community need to get better at separating people out of boxes and stop looking at everybody as either exactly the same as the person they're working under or all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you can't say that, you know, all these other teams weren't right about it, going for it in some way, shape, or form, and trying to recapture it. And, you know, is the process flawed? Absolutely. And do we need better candidates and more diverse candidates? Absolutely. But at the same time, McVay is kind of proof that if you feel like going for it, then I think that there's a reward to that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it looks like Zach Taylor and Matt LaFleur are sort of like taking the model that Sean built in, and even Cliff Kingsbury too, taking the model that like that Sean built in LA with a veteran defensive coordinator and then like guys they trust on offense, like taking that model and putting it in other places. So it'll be interesting to see. You guys pumped for the Pro Bowl on Sunday then? Because if we've been picking games, we can pick the Pro Bowl if you guys want.
Oh, that's a great thing to pick. Yeah, let's.
You guys
do
see
it.
Mitchell's in the Pro Bowl?
Mitchell Trubisky?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I middle of the day yesterday dropped in my inbox was an announcement from the Bears. Mitchell Trubisky is in the Pro Bowl.
That is three players from that draft class, by the way, then. I mean, I know that you can say what you want about how the Pro Bowl selection process happens and some, you know, Tyrod Taylor was also a Pro Bowl quarterback, but that is three, I think, right? That is three players in that class that made the Pro Bowl this year. It's pretty,
which is crazy. It wasn't even, it should be a lesson to all of us too, because it was like, I mean, you remember, like, that class was like, well, you know, this class is okay, but wait until 2018 when Josh Rosen and Sam Darnold and Josh Allen are coming out. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think a lot of people looked at that, the 17 class, were like, eh. And now all three of those guys won division titles. All three of those guys are in the Pro Bowl. And I'm pumped for the Pro Bowl, too. It's an exciting Sunday.
That used to be, when I used to work for the NFL, I was not important enough to be invited to the Super Bowl, and so I would go to the Pro Bowl. And so that would be my big, that was my event. And so I remember, you know, doing all the research, getting super jazzed about the Pro Bowl every year. That was my thing.
Scouting reports.
Access is great there, isn't it?
Access is phenomenal. I learned to love I did the last year in Hawaii, which was,
yeah, I was going
to
say, Connor, that was
the
greatest.
Yeah, like, but that's not that, like, I don't know if I feel too bad for you.
Work boondoggle of all time, you know, totally amazing. But then the 2 years in Orlando were nice too. I think that when it all comes down to it, seeing Odell Beckham, you know, at Disney World, like dancing with all the kids, I mean, that's really the baseline of like what this game is about, the accessibility to players who want to be around young fans and sign autographs. And I think that being at Disney sort of accomplishes a lot of that for the people who really love football. And so I'm getting like overly sentimental about the Pro Bowl.
You really are. This is like a real Pro Bowl pitch. Oh. NFL that kid maybe who has they contacted you since you put that out there a couple of minutes ago, Connor.
I'm gonna check my Venmo.
That young Connor Orr who's dreaming of meeting Mitchell Trubisky, that dream just came true for him the other day.
Absolutely.
All right, see you guys next week. All right, we're gonna jump right into the six pack. You guys know how this works. Every Tuesday I put the call for questions out on Twitter. If I pick yours, I give you a little like on Twitter. That means I hit that little heart there. And you get an answer here on the podcast. Question number one, and I'm going to butcher your name, Leonid Antisferov. And that's at C. Sander Leo. Hey, Albert. Hello from Russia. It looks like the Cards won't have an OC on their staff. Also, Arians OC Harold Goodwin in Arizona was just an assistant. Does today's teams need a squad of head coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator on staff with so many head coaches taking responsibility and play calling? Can it become a trend? I think that what you're talking about here, Leonid, is, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right there, is semantics. All of this to me is just what you want to call what different guys' jobs are. And if the head coach is the offensive play caller, then generally the structure of it, you're going to probably have a guy who's a pass game coordinator. And then your line coach is probably going to be your run game coordinator. And Harold Goodwin is, to some degree, the run game coordinator in Tampa. You got Byron Leftwich, who they say is going to be the play caller as the pass game coordinator. And it's sort of just the way that those titles work out. It normally has more to do with the way that you're paying a guy than it has to do with how you're actually putting him into practice. Obviously in Arizona with Cliff Kingsbury, you've got a guy in Tom Clements who's going to be the pass game coordinator, and then you've got Sean Kugler, who's the line coach, doesn't have the title of run game coordinator, but in essence will be doing that. And so they'll be setting stuff up for Cliff to call the plays. And so a lot of this just sort of, can affect how guys are paid, so it's not unimportant, but a lot of times, based on roles, it can be semantics. Question number two from Olmedo Miranda B. That's at ODM21. Was Breeze injured during the last stretch of the season? Maybe shoulder related. The drop off in deep throws is weird. I think he was just challenged in different ways by defenses, and I also think that the one thing that did hurt him later in the year, teams played them differently without Ted Ginn in there. That sort of materialized in October. It affected how teams were able to cover Michael Thomas. Just think that the circumstances sort of changed. And, I mean, look, it was going to be tough for them to keep up the pace that they kept up for the first 2 months of the season. That said, it did look like he wore down a little bit, so it's absolutely something worth watching because guys like him and Tom Brady, from an age standpoint, are getting into uncharted territory for franchise quarterbacks in the league. Like Brett Favre played great in the season that he turned 40. The next year, turned 41 during the season, it wasn't so good. So both Brady and Breeze are now in uncharted territory, so you're always going to be looking out for stuff like that. All right, question number three. This is from In Green Mints. That's at In Green Mints. AB, if not the Steelers, where and what kind of money is he after? I don't know for a fact that he wants a new contract. He, when he got his deal, was the highest paid receiver in the history of the game. A lot of the big money is gone now because the deal was front loaded, like a lot of these deals are. His contract going forward is affordable. It's 3 years and $39 million left on there. Like, if you're trading for him, that's what you inherit. And so he'll be making less for you than Allen Robinson is for the Bears, than Sammy Watkins is for the Chiefs, than Mike Evans is for the Bucks. So the money part of it, I think, is good if it stays the same, if he doesn't demand a new deal. Where could I see him going? San Francisco is one team that I know is going to be out there looking to get more explosive, and he could certainly provide that. And then I think the Redskins are a team that you always sort of put on the radar when it comes to a player like this. And so those would be the two teams I'm watching. I guess Tampa would be an outside possibility. I would have considered them stronger if Bruce Arians hadn't said what he's already said about that situation. Question number four. This is hashtag believe with 15 in it. Mahomes at Bill Groner 1. With emphasis on offense, overtime rules, and revenue, especially in the postseason. With the current rules, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan, and Pat Mahomes never touched the ball. Tom Brady won two of those. Has he been left on the bench? Needs conversation. So I don't know exactly what you're asking here, but like I said earlier in the show, I believe that the overtime rules are fine the way that they are. I don't have a huge problem with the way that they do it. I think special teams should be part of the game. If you go to the college overtime, you take special teams out of it. I'm not wild about that. And I wouldn't mind seeing like a full period, but if you're playing like a full 10-minute period, right, like the way they play full 5-minute periods in basketball, yeah, then you still run the risk that a team just milks the clock and, you know, drives the field and the other team never sees the ball anyway. So I don't mind the way it is. I think it's just fine. And I don't, like, again, I don't view, like, the fact that we all wanted to see Pat Mahomes get the ball, which we all did feel like Pat Mahomes, like, I think we all wanted to see that. We all wanted to see Mahomes with a chance to come back. That's not a valid reason for changing a rule. Question number 5, this is from Don Ridenour, at Don Ridenour. Who will the Cowboys OC be? I believe right now that it'll be Kellen Moore with John Kitna as the quarterback coach. I think, I know where this isn't exciting for Cowboys fans. I just tell you what I know based on what other coaches on that staff have told me about him, which is that he's very open to doing things a different way. He's well-respected by the players. He was a player. He's obviously been doing it his whole life, or he's been around it his whole life because his dad's a high school coach. And he came from a place in Boise where they're pretty innovative offensively. He played under Chris Peterson, who's been pretty innovative offensively over the years. So he's got background in doing things a different way. And I 100% think that that's what Jerry and Stephen Jones are looking for. When they made the when the Cowboys were struggling earlier in the year, I do believe there was a point where Jason Garrett was in a little bit of trouble. And I think there are two coaches that they would have moved away from Jason Garrett for. One's Lincoln Riley at Oklahoma. The other is Sean Payton. What do those two guys have in common? They're both offensive innovators. And so I think that that's what the Cowboys are looking for. It's why they moved away from Scott Linehan. And I think Kellen Moore gives them a chance to maintain some level of continuity while also bringing some new innovation to the table. Question number 6, in the kitchens with Freddie, that's at Awesome Stout. And shout out to my buddy Dustin Fox for helping me out with the connection here. It was a fire drill this morning trying to get this thing set up. And so we're going to answer a question for his fan base here. Realistic win total for the Browns next year. I say 8 as currently constructed and barring an injury to Mayfield. What do you think, Dustin?
I say 8 wins is the floor, but my co-host Adam the Bull says 9 or 10. If it's short of 9 or 10, it's a disappointment.
All right, so that's Dustin Fox, who you can catch on 92.3 The Fan in Cleveland. Weekdays, what is it, 2 to 7. Weekdays 2 to 7. I'm actually with the Bull. I think that I think the over-under based on the talent there, I'd say like 9.5 should be the over-under. Like if it's lower than that, I can understand based on the history of the franchise, but I would set the over-under right around 9.5.
My degenerate friends think Vegas will set it at 8.5, the total.
Okay, and that's probably
accurate.
Yeah, okay, so I trust the degenerates on this sort of thing. So maybe 8.5 is 8.5 might be the more realistic. I would set it at 9.5. I think that 10 wins would be a big win for Freddie Kitchens and that staff. I think that they've got one of the best bases of under 25 talent, like under the age of 25, the guys they have in that roster. Denzel Ward, David Joku, Nick Chubb, Baker Mayfield, obviously, Miles Garrett. I don't think Larry Ogunjobi's that young, but he's right there. Like there are a lot of really, really good young players in that roster. And so I don't mind saying I think that can be a 10-win team next year. It's not crazy to think that Mayfield makes the same sort of jumps in year two that, say, like Carson Wentz made before he got hurt in his second year, and the Eagles won the Super Bowl that year. All right, appreciate you guys coming out. Again, a little bit of a different sound this week, I know, because the mechanics were a little messed up with me here in Mobile and Jenny and Connor in New York. We'll all be together again next week in Atlanta. You guys can check us out then. And always remember to listen to all the MMQB podcasts, all in one feed now. The MMQB podcast with Andy and Gary. They do 2 editions during the week, the gambling podcast, and of course this podcast, the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. You can get us on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. Same time next week. We'll see you guys there.